Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Coffee with Candace. I'm your host, Candace Mama. Today's episode is the one I'm so thrilled to bring you because it's not just with a guest I went out and found, it is with one of my closest friends and confidants. Elissa Iyanakone is one of the hardest working and most resilient people I know. And I thought, who better to speak to at a time like this when all of us are looking to cultivate our resilience? Elissa and I have a show titled The Candace and Elissa Show. But besides that, Elissa has worked in over 30 countries across 5 continents. She has been a war journalist covering the robber massacre in Cairo. She's dealt with domestic violence issues in the Iraqi refugee camps. She has worked with every organization you can think of, including Vice, BBC World, Newsweek, and so many others. Very recently, she added her book, Spiral of Containment, to her large repertoire of business. And so, without further ado, here's my good friend, Elissa.
Hello.
Hello, queen.
Good to see you.
How are you?
Good. I am happy to be here.
I'm so happy you're here. Oh my God. I have to tell you, like, I am so excited for our interview for so many reasons, right? Like, usually the people I interview are people like, you know, I go out there and I find, and then later we become friends. And I'm interviewing you, and you are my friend.
We're doing it backwards.
And I can't be happier. Like, I couldn't be happier because I was sitting one day and I just remember thinking to myself, I'm like, you are such an incredible woman and you've done so many incredible things in your life and you're going to continue to do even more and greater and more expansive. Exactly, expansive things. For the people who cannot see us and are listening just via podcast, Elissa just broke out into a dance, which is why you know we are friends. But I'm so honored to just have you in as a friend of mine, but also just, you know, on this platform, because I know your story and who you are is just going to impact so many people.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here and yeah, love hanging out with you. So this is going to be a walk in the park.
It already is. We've already started our first dance.
A dance in the park.
Exactly. So when I was like doing my research on you, which I didn't have to do that much because I thought I knew you very well, right? But I mean, I had to go back in time and I remembered when we first met. And we met at an event, which was for Tears, an organization that helps women who've dealt with sexual violence. And I remember we were sat next to each other and we started talking and someone actually facilitated our interaction. And it was amazing. We started talking. But even at that point, I didn't know your story. So do you want to start there? Do you want to tell us, like, what is your story that, you know, connected you and I?
Yeah, well, I think you and I connected over the fact that we've overcome big trauma. And in my personal case, it was because I was raped when I was 23 by someone that I considered to be an older brother figure when I grew up in Mexico, which is where I'm originally from. And as a result of that, I not only had to deal with the incident, but I also had to deal with a ripple effect of losing all of my extended family who slowly started deleting me on social media without ever having spoken to me. And the one person that I did speak to, who was his mother and my godmother, which within Catholicism is like a big deal, it's like your second mom, point blank just told me she did not believe that what I said had happened had. So it was just harder to process the loss of my family than it was to process what had actually happened, I think. And as a result of that, I did art therapy as a cinematographer and visual thinker. It's something that worked really, really well for me. And in that process, I discovered that I had lots of images that came into my mind regarding what had happened, particularly one about myself feeling that I had broken wings. And I had this skeletal figure of wings coming out of my back, but they just had no feathers. And everyone else was still flying, going in their direction, pursuing their dreams. And I had this carcass that was now unusable, but just that reminder that at some point in my life I'd been flying too. Once that came to mind and I finished doing lots of therapy, I decided to reach out to other rape survivors, men, women, different races, different ages, to see if we could all concoct our image of broken wings together, like in my kitchen, only to discover that each person had their own imagery. It wasn't about broken wings. It was about being underwater, being in a cage, being shut out from society, all these kinds of things. And as a visual thinker, I just realized, oh my God, we've got such a huge world of imagery here. Why don't I just make it come to be? And then we can make a collective stance against sexual violence. And so that's what I did. I worked with 24 rape survivors plus myself, one representing each color in the 24 color wheel plus black and white, to cohesively kind of put the images together, and then wrote a book about it, and it all kind of grew from there. So that's, in a nutshell, that part of my story.
Wow. Like, it gives me chills. And I mean, I hear you, like, I've heard you speak about it, and every time you retell it, like, it gives me so many chills, because trauma is such a massive thing, right? Especially when you've experienced it and then you get isolated from your family. I can't even imagine the difficulty of that. And so did you stay in Mexico, or did you end up moving elsewhere, or how did that transpire for you?
Well, I, at the time, had already left home to study filmmaking in Canada. So I lived in Toronto. I had just gone back to Mexico to shoot a documentary with a company that I had just started with a friend. And this happened. And so I went back to Toronto and completely was rendered useless in my career. I ended up working as a telemarketer in a basement because I'd run out of money, and I just needed to pay for therapy while the government could give me a therapy program, which I'm very grateful for. I couldn't pick up a camera for about a year. I couldn't really do my thing, you know. I kept on having this image of being like at the side of a mountain made of ice. And with your hands, it just keeps melting and you just feel like you're trying to just keep it together, but you can't. I was in Canada, luckily got myself back on my feet, and then ended up working as a filmmaker and cinematographer around the world in 6 continents. So ended up being a bit of a nomadic person.
Yeah. So do you believe that it was the art therapy that ended up leading you to cinematography and like that world of journalism? Or were you going to do that regardless?
Yeah, I knew that I wanted to be a filmmaker since I was 12. And at that point, I had already graduated from university and I had specialized in cinematography. I initially thought I wanted to be a film director until I was forced to shoot someone's film, basically forced. And then, you know, you start with 16 millimeter film and you actually have to put the reel in and develop it. And then when you see these images come to life and you have that fear of, did I expose this right? What is going on? You know, and then suddenly you see magic happen. I just went, ooh, this is it. This is very exciting.
I love it. So you've worked in so many crisis zones. I mean, places and situations that so many people could not imagine. You worked in Cairo, Egypt, right? A part of the Rahba massacre, if I'm not mistaken. How was that experience for you? I mean, how did you manage to cope? Because so many people that have been war correspondents or, you know, have worked in these kind of zones, like, they struggle and a lot of them end up breaking apart when they get back home. So how was that whole experience for you and how did you adapt to it?
You know, it's funny because I think since I was quite young, I was building towards trying to get somewhere like that subconsciously. You know, when I was 16, I used to work on ambulances in Mexico as a volunteer because the Mexican system is very, very volunteer driven. So I had been exposed to, you know, a lot of blood and death and all these kinds of things, had a lot of people die in my family. You know, Mexico is a very open casket kind of country. So you're kind of growing up in a place that life and death is just in your face since you're quite young. So I think by the time I had finished my career, I realized how desperately I wanted to cover something that in my mind meant something more than just making pretty images. And so I did do a master's degree in London to specialize in conflict zone reporting in international journalism, and then moved to the Middle East. And that's where I was covering Egypt, and I was there to do my final master's program just report on the City of the Dead, which is a large necropolis. And then at the same time, in parallel, all of these things with the government and political scene were starting to happen. So I kind of went in there out of curiosity initially, and then found myself reporting for major news outlets without even knowing how that had happened. And suddenly we did witness massacres that happened in over the course of several days. Thousands of people were killed. And it was really, it was hard because you got attached to certain people. You know, you'd go to a protest, you'd make friends, and you know, these are not lifelong friends, but there are friends that you see every day, and suddenly you don't know if they lived or died, and you know that some did die, and you saw the government burn people alive and all this kind of thing. You just go, wow, how do we as humans get ourselves to this place? And I think it's a highly introspective space to operate in. And for me personally, I just needed to give myself space to decompress from it. So I cried a lot, and I mourned a lot of losses through that period. And I think that's what kept me sane, because I allowed myself that space. And I think a lot of people don't. And I think that can be where you get stuck.
Oof, the stuck. I mean, you and I have so many similar views, right, on a lot of things. Hence, we've got a show together. But the one thing you touched on, especially, you know, when it comes to trauma and processing trauma, and I think you experienced it because I experienced it in my work too, is a lot of people have a fear of expressing or experiencing the pain of loss or sadness. And I find that a lot of them, it's because they're scared they won't get out, right? Like there's this innate feeling that if I allow myself to collapse right now, or if I allow myself to feel this or cry, am I ever going to leave the space? And you mentioned it so well by saying you've got to feel it. It sucks.
Yeah.
It's painful. But there is that release. It's like it happens from your soul, right? It doesn't, it's not like a superficial thing where you're trying to think it out of existence and you're trying to put the pieces together in your head and be like, okay, you know, I've dealt with it. But it's more of a situation like you got to go into that like darkness. It's almost like it forces you to confront yourself. Is that what you found? Because that's what I found in my healing, the self-confrontation, I think, which I was not expecting.
One analogy that I always like to use for this is cinematography itself, you know, because when you grab a camera and you're trying to compose an image, they always say in film school, start with a dark room. The first light you turn on is the first stroke, right? If you start to look at light as an ability to paint, every single one having intensity, direction, everything. Had you a completely bright room from the start, you would never be able to compose an interesting image, right? So I see this as an analogy for life. And that's why I really like the craft of it, because, you know, we're always kind of told to strive for happiness and joy and whatever. And it's not a permanent state. Contentedness might be more permanent, but had we not those low points, had we not those challenges, those obstacles, we would never be able to appreciate the moments where things are going our way and the things where we're feeling bright and happy about things. So I genuinely believe that life has to have that two-sidedness. Otherwise, we would never be able to just feel rich and wholesome, you know? So yeah, I think confronting and not fearing, it's not about not getting stuck there. It's about understanding that it's just a part of it all. And tears do come to an end. If you allow the waterfall, they do stop. Like, I think a lot of people get stuck on that fear that if I start crying, I'm never going to stop. No, you will. You will. It might take a while. But once you let the tears run dry, you have also harnessed that strength of knowing that you've allowed yourself to process something and given yourself the time you need to process something and been respectful of that. Which is very important, I think.
When you said strength, it like really struck me, because we don't associate necessarily, you know, tears or emotions with strength. We don't associate, you know, coming to terms and facing yourself with strength, right? And I actually think that it is one of the biggest acts of strength that one can display. And that's what I find to be so powerful. I mean, your whole analogy is incredibly powerful. But I think that for me, it is in my darkest moments, it is in my biggest moments of trauma, of pain, of life experience, that I have harnessed the ability to know without a shadow of a doubt what I'm made of, right? And I find that a lot of people don't allow themselves moments of pain, so they don't strive for their dreams, they don't, you know, go after the person they love, they don't, because they want to insulate themselves from pain. But it's through going and reaching and leaping for that goal that you're like, oh, shit, I'm falling, damn, crash. You know? And it's like when you're lying on the pavement face down and you're like, am I dead? And then you realize you're not dead and you stand up. You're like, holy crap, I fell from that height and I made it. I'm a badass.
Yes. And when you're down there, there's only one way to go, right? So it's not all bad. You can just take a moment and look up, but realize that you know what it's like to be up there. You know what your true path is. You know where you're comfortable living, but it's okay to just take a step down and look up and realize, man, because that also lets you look at how far you've come. It makes you go, wow, I have built something and I didn't even take a moment to realize it before. If you fall down, it means that you've made it up. And that's also a good realization, because sometimes we just ignore anything that we've done. We're always perpetually looking up and we don't take a moment to look back at how low we were when we started, perhaps, you know?
Yeah. And I, like, for me, do you think it's a mindset? Do you think that people, you know, because both you and I have experienced tragedy, right? And we've continued to face other tragedies. It's just that they're not as big as the main one, I'd say. But the way we tend to analyze and confront these situations and move through them is not necessarily the natural human conditioning for a lot of people, I find. So do you think this is an innate quality, or it's something that you train? Like, what do you think it is? Because I'm trying to still figure that out for myself.
I think exposure to it does help. You know, I often used to think, even going through school in a first world country like Canada or the UK, I would see students coming from Latin countries or African countries or certain Asian countries, sometimes just showcase more resilience towards assignments even, and have a more go-getter attitude than people that just had felt a normal state of safety the whole time. It almost felt like a lot of people didn't feel they had to fight for much. Whereas a lot of other ones like us, we're like, I have had to like claw my way up here. Like, I still have memories of, you know, being in Mexico, living in a trailer park as a child because my parents lost all their money in a moment in time, and just going, man, and you made it to a university in London paying in pounds. Like, that's a big journey. Like, you don't just get there by wishing it. You've made a ton of sacrifices to get there. Somebody who just, you know, lived in this country their whole life and just went to university, as most people might have done in their family, perhaps generally this, it's a different form of appreciation. And it's a different form of resilience. That's not to say there's not validity in it, because they are operating from a more secure place and they might have more secure attachments. They might have many things that are more constructive in that way. I do think that it gives you practice for when things don't go your way, because you're so used to things not going your way and you're so used to navigating through a tempestuous ocean that I think you build muscle in a way.
I love that. Oh, I love that. And it actually brings me to there are a couple of points you raised that I really want to talk about. The one, you know, you having to live in a trailer park, because I'd like to go through these experiences to show that, you know, you weren't just like a wunderkind, you know, like born and kissed by the angels, but it did take real like resilience and hard work to get to where you are. And then I want to speak about trauma and how it impacts, you know, one's ambitions and goals. But I first want to start with, I did an interview last week with Kate Gray. So she also has a phenomenal story, phenomenal woman. And one thing she mentioned about growing up, she grew up in a very similar situation to how we did, very tumultuous, very, you know, unstable. And the one thing she said is, she knows for a fact that she's developed this inner strength to push through any obstacle. Like when it comes to business, when it comes to a career, she can endure. But she's like, that endurance doesn't necessarily translate well into interpersonal relationships. And I remember as she said it, I was like, that's exactly me. Like, I don't care where you put me in the world, what situation, I know I'm going to figure it out. I know it might take me some time, but I'm going to get back up and I'm going to fight my way out of there. Like, you are not just going to take me out without me kicking and screaming. Like, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die swinging, you know? And I know it's exactly the same with you. It's exactly the same. And I want you to just like, tell us, like, what's your opinion about that? Like, what do you think it is that like where we develop this huge resilience, but it doesn't necessarily translate well into the interpersonal aspects of our lives? Or have you found that, or has that been like fun for you?
Do you mean like in the way that we relate to other people?
Yeah, like relationships, especially like when you enter relationships with that, like never say die attitude, or like that wounded, you know, that's self-protective, because in many ways, right, the skill set you require for business, for the kind of careers we do, you require very thick skin, and you have to be able to shut off your emotions. You have to be able to shut off and get things done, which is a strong skill set to have when you're ambitious, which we are, but it's not a great skill set to have in a relationship, you know? So how have you navigated that? And have you found that that's been problematic at all in your life?
100% it has. So I think, you know, as you mentioned, we both did grow up in tempestuous environments. You know, my parents did have a rather volatile relationship, and especially going through such difficult things like losing their money, ending up in a trailer park for a while, all these things put a lot of strain and pressure. And my parents were from completely different cultures. They literally barely spoke each other's language. So they had a lot of miscommunications, right? So I think that the benefit of having something like that is that you learn what you don't really want to replicate. The problem is that because it's the only thing you've seen, you don't know how to not repeat that model. So I think for a while, I did find myself gravitating towards people that felt familiar because of where I'd come from, and replicating models, ending up fighting with people, having lots of arguments, having lots of tears, having lots of drama, attracting drama, and just not really quite being able to harness what I was thinking I wanted, but not really able to acquire. And I have to be honest, it wasn't until the sexual assault happened that I really just took a pause in my life, because I had to. But I did lots of therapy, not just for the assault, but for, you know, ways of communicating, for interfamiliar violence, for these kinds of things, and discovered that a lot of the things that I had learned in terms of how to communicate, how to relate to another person, were not the healthiest. And I really think that that year, even though career-wise it was a gap and it completely derailed many things that I was doing, it was an ability to start having a different kind of relationship. So for me, it really was therapy. And there was a literal shift in the kind of person that I attracted and the kind of person that I became attracted to. And then I would say that after that, my relationships became very different. And every time I made a conscious choice to be as communicative as possible, as healthy as possible. And, you know, I still have a therapist, you know, I believe in that. That works for me. I'm not saying that works for every person, but if it does, I mean, there's no shame in it. And I think as long as you're continually growing and bettering yourself, especially if you've been through a lot, life can only get better.
Oh, that gave me so many chills. And I think of it just in my own, you know, experience, and just, you know, I do a lot of journaling. I do a lot of writing and, you know, trying to figure out what's in my head. And I think sometimes with people like us, when you have experience, when I refer to people like us, and speaking to everyone who's listening, who's experienced trauma, like, you know, in any way that still impacts them today. I find that when I try and figure things out in my head, I go into a spiral. Like, that is one of the most like unhealthy things you can do for yourself, right? Like, trying to work out a problem that's literally living in your head. It's like fighting yourself, right? It doesn't work. And so when I started really becoming consciously, like, I'd consciously journal, because I mean, I was writing since I was like 8, you know, which is really crazy. Like I'd sit in front of like Disney when we still had the cassette tapes and I would rewind those songs and I would write it word for word because internet was not a thing. And I would write it and then I'd write my own reflections on this love song on Little Mermaid or like on Mulan. I mean, I don't know what I thought I was doing, but there it was. And then I developed the habit of writing pretty early on. But the problem is what I started realizing I was doing, I was just like using my journals as a dump, like just as a dump of just useless information in the sense that today, you know, this person hurt me and today I'm going through that, which isn't actually that useful if you think about it. Like, yes, picking up diaries from like 2 years, 3 years ago, I'm like, that happened. You made that life decision. But what I've started doing now is very consciously writing. And so conscious writing for me has been really interrogating thought patterns, interrogating communication styles, interrogating interpersonal unions and relationships, the kind of men I chase and choose. And I use the word chase very deliberately because your girl is Usain Bolt. Like, I've always got my running shoes ready to chase somebody. But like, and even that, right, the idea of it. And what I want to come back to is the idea of, you know, in the law of attraction community, there's this idea of like, you attract what you are, you attract what you think, and that kind of dynamic. I've believed in the law of attraction for a while. I don't believe in that. I don't believe you attract situations into your life. I think a better mindset puts you in better spaces. It impacts your habits and habitual behavior, which puts you in certain scenarios and circumstances that influence what happens in your life. But I don't think you can sit there and call upon you certain things, whether it's positive or negative. I don't believe you can. I can sit here with you and we can meditate and visualize a Ferrari and just keep sitting here and hope it's going to pitch up at our doors, right? But I do believe that if we intentionally speak to each other about, hey, we've got this dream, you and I really want to work together and have a show together, but we're really putting in the conscious work and we have a positive state of mind around it, but we also develop our skill sets all the time, right? And so when it comes to attracting or dating certain types of people, I think, like, I want to know your thoughts on this, because I find that a lot of people who've been through either sexual assault or, you know, massive traumas really struggle with the idea of, Elissa, like, how do I know that this person is, you know, here so that I can learn a lesson from life? And how do I know that this person is worth it if I've never seen healthy before? Because I don't know about you, but the biggest thing I struggle with in relationships is identifying what is healthy and normal versus what is unhealthy and abnormal. Because what's been normal to me and what I saw growing up is 100% abnormal in every situation. But I still find myself gravitating towards it on a very subconscious level. Like, and it becomes very like small things that I find myself looking at myself and being like, huh? You know? So what do you say to people? Because I mean, people seek you out all the time to ask for your advice on this matter, especially after experiencing sexual assault.
I mean, I think the key here is that you don't know. And you don't know, even if you've had the healthiest upbringing, you just don't know. We don't all have, you know, magic crystal balls to look into the future. We don't know. You just have to try and make the best judgment call with the tools you've got in that moment. And that's really the best you can do. Whether it becomes a lesson or a lifelong journey, something that, you know, I don't even know. I'm married now, but I remember when I first met my husband, I felt a very intense, quick attraction to him from the beginning. And that made me take a step back and question, am I very attracted to this person because he's familiar? And I actually for a while kind of pushed it away because I was like, this is familiar. He feels too familiar. It can't be good. So it's funny because there I was self-sabotaging something that was very, very good. Yes. But I was scared of it because I had sometimes attached to people that were immediate connections and were wrong. I didn't know. And look how it turned out. It turned out great, right? But that was a very long, convoluted story that we'll get to another time. But but I think in the end, it's about detecting where are our loose screws. And by loose screws, I don't mean, are you crazy? I mean, if you've built a house are there certain parts of it, are there certain walls that you can already see, this is a bit wonky, this is a bit, you know, this might fall down? You are the best judge of the parts of you that are not fully healed, that are maybe a bit too desperate about something, maybe trying to fill a void. You know where it hurts. You know what hurts. You know what your buttons are. And if you don't, all you got to do is just sit down and have a look at things that trigger you. When do you get really, really angry? Because underneath anger, there's always pain. Where do you get really, really sad? You know, what are those things? And those are the answers. Once you start to really decant that, it's easier to understand why you're attaching to someone. What are they bringing into your life that they're easing or soothing or maybe even healing? And is it a positive thing or not? And you're the best judge. So I think trusting our gut is the number one place to go, and being truthful with what we're feeling, because we always repress what our gut is saying. No, 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 it can't be saying that. Or I don't want it to be saying that because I want this relationship to work this time because I've put in 5 years and it cannot go down the train, right? Mm. It's trusting what your gut is saying. And I think just continuously checking in with yourself, that is really the best thing you can do. And that's all I can say, because there's no magic wand, and nobody can control it till the end.
I wish there kind of was, right? Like a sweep. I'm healed. Yes. Because you know what? One of the biggest discoveries I made through healing is anytime you find yourself at a space of like feeling as though you're completing a healing journey or experience, I don't know if it's life, I don't know if it's human nature, but something else will represent or come into your life that triggers a different part of you, that then now you have to go into a different form of healing where you're like, ah, I thought I was done with this. But I want to know, like, how did you, you know, using the tools you've learned in therapy and everything else, how did you learn how to trust yourself again? How did you learn how to build that good, solid relationship with you?
I think it was by not trusting myself for a very long time and kind of walking away from myself and then realizing how weak I felt, which is a very like uncomfortable space for me. So when you don't trust yourself, you're very hesitant to make decisions and you're very scared about messing up. And I felt like it was in a bit of a kind of man on wire situation where you're always tippy toeing. You don't know if you're going to fall or not. And you're just living in this constant state of fear, which I just couldn't sustain. I chose not to sustain. I just said, you know, the rest of my life is not going to be this way. And I am stuck with myself, whether I like it or not. I mean, this is why Aristotle always talked about the body is a cage, right? You know, we are in our body and it can be a cage or it can be an ally. And the moment you start to relate to yourself as an ally to yourself, it sounds pretty basic, but we're often going opposite to what we should be to help ourselves forward. I think it's a conscious choice to just go, whatever it is, I am the best judge for myself because nobody else is inside this body. And it's a conscious choice and it's hard because you know what? You will continue to make mistakes and we will continue to make painful decisions. It's not like, I think in one of your interviews with Evie Pompura, she said, you know, life hands you garbage sometimes. And it's true. Sometimes that's what happens. But if you don't trust yourself, you're going to end up in the dumpster with it. You're not going to have the ability to have it shed off of you and keep walking forward. And I think that's the part that we have to work on. It's not easy. Sometimes it's easier to just go, oh my God, drama, drama. You need it to cry a bit, whatever. But you got to pick up the pieces because otherwise life just throws you away. And do you want that? No. I mean, it's a very personal question, I think.
Oh, man. That gives me chills because it's one of those things, right, that people don't understand how empowering responsibility is, you know. And I think sometimes, like yesterday, I just went on my Instagram to talk about, you know, how important the language we use with ourselves is. And I mean, how powerful that is. When you go through life acting and calling yourself a victim, life will give you situations that you are going to react to it in a very victim-like mode, and people can live. And that's, I think for me, probably the part I like the least about my career, where that's helping people, you know, get to the best version of themselves, is honestly just observing how many people are going to die the same. I think that's one of the hardest things to witness, that they're just some people who will never get to a point of taking personal accountability. They'll just never, every stage in their life, they perceive as the worst stage in their life. No matter when you bump into them, you can bump into them when they're 25, 35, 75, and they're the same person. And I find that to be one of the hardest things to watch, right? Like, have you ever met those people where you just look at them and you're like, this is so sad. Like, you will never, ever get to a place of just saying, hey, maybe I have a role in this life thing, you know, and it's so hard.
100%. I mean, and I think what's most frustrating is that you as an outsider perceive the incredible potential, the incredible positive energy that this person can tap into, right? And the great things that they can do, but there's a choice not to. And I think, you know, in Mexico, we have an expression that I don't know if it's going to translate, but it's don't wear the suit jacket that doesn't belong to you, which I extrapolate to, you know, don't wear a sack of rocks on your back, you know, if you don't have to. If it doesn't belong to you, let it slide. But so often, sometimes because of culture, religion, all these different kinds of things, we are conditioned to take on things because it's seen as being the good person. You got to be the martyr. You got to be the, you know, not self-serving and all this kind of stuff. And sometimes we kind of lose perspective of what that genuinely means by taking on things that don't belong to us. I think everybody has hope. You know, there might be someone that wakes up at 95 and goes, actually, I'm going to change today. And that's okay. And that is absolutely fine because everybody's got their journey and everybody has their time. But yeah, I can absolutely empathize with you that it can be very frustrating, especially when you see someone you care about, you know, and you can see that potential, but you don't know how long it's going to take for them to wake up, if at all. It's tough. It's tough.
And I love what you touched on there about, you know, the self not being looked at as a good thing, right? Like, I think in society, in so many ways, now the movement is self-love. But even in that statement, what I find to be really ironic is the very thing that got us to a point where we are so detached from ourselves and we're trying so hard to constantly be what we're not, is the fact that we, from like this high, society tells you what is beautiful, what is this, what is that, and what you're supposed to aspire towards, right? And so you always feel like, I'm not good enough, regardless of who you are, how you look, whatever. There's always someone, you always pitch the idea that there's someone better, there's someone smarter, there's someone more beautiful, always. And I mean, in our industry, it's even more so, right? But then what I find interesting now with the self-love movement is almost, it's taking on this very bypassy energy. And when I speak about bypassing energy, it's buy the salt bath and soak in it. And then that is self-love. You know, go take yourself to a spa. All these things that are outside of yourself, go do that. But don't actually do the work of loving yourself, which is the hard part.
Or take the time to make the structural changes in your life so that you don't feel that you need to self-love or self-care, and that means stepping completely out of your routine, because otherwise you feel like you haven't self-cared. And that's a structural change. Well, the other stuff is just patchwork. It's band-aids. It's like, yes, the bath salts, the spa day. That's a band-aid. That means that there are structural changes needed. Another thing that you touched on that I think is quite interesting is, you know, my grandfather and my mom always say the only race you're in this world is with yourself. And that has always been so interesting to me, because the moment I start to get lost in the social media pool, because yes, there will always be someone better and there will always be someone worse. What does it matter? In the end, the question is not how many people are better, it's how much better could I be? Am I fulfilling my full potential right now? Or am I holding back? And the moment, I'm not saying that we need to isolate ourselves to the point of not interacting with people and being so self-centered. It's just the knowledge that we are not here to compare ourselves to each other. We are here to develop ourselves to the best of our ability. And if we turn inwards to be really transparent and mirror ourselves, and that's the moment that we can really see where we're going wrong, right? So I always like that comment.
That's powerful. That's so powerful, because I think both of us, I mean, in the past year or so, 2 years, I mean, we're very similar in our spiritual journey. That's why we're such good friends, but or our evolution journey, I should say, which is establishing what, like, where do you end and where does someone else begin, right? Because I also think that the one biggest thing that I struggled with so much is when you are in this industry of being of service, the humanitarian field, you know, the speaking industry, even writing books, right? The whole compass of what we do, it is very much like not only like asked of, but it's also very much expected that you should always be self-sacrificial for the greater good of others. And taking that back and actually being like, ooh, I'm not even liking the person I'm becoming because I feel like I'm giving too much. And when you feel like as soon as too much becomes a question or it becomes an issue, guess what? It builds resentment, right? And when I started finding myself becoming resentful, I was like, wait, I need to step back and figure out what's going on with myself, because the alarm started going off. And a beautiful thing we've both been on is boundaries. And how have you found that boundaries? I mean, we will speak about this for forever because it's one of the most revolutionary things I think I've ever discovered. It's just crazy. But how has implementing boundaries been for you? And what does that look like right now?
I mean, I think boundaries is a constant learning curve for me, because, you know, as you navigate, you're always encountering new people, new things, new situations. And sometimes you're not sure from the get-go where you want to set your boundaries, right? You mentioned one word a bit earlier, which was spiral. Sometimes you can start to spiral with trauma or all these kinds of things, which is a big word for me because that's the core title of my book and my work, The Spiral of Containment. And the reason I called it that is because it doesn't just have to apply to sexual violence. It applies to anyone. We all have a world contained within us all that nobody else has access to and nobody else can fully grasp or understand. We are the authors and we are the ones that understand what exactly it is we're going through and what it is that we're showing to the world. And sometimes it's not the same, and that's okay. Setting boundaries is being truthful to that world that's within you and being able to decant what is best for you. And doing that is not selfish. It might be viewed as being selfish, but the reality of that very basic thing about operating from the glass half empty versus operating from the overflow. The reality of the matter is what you said, if you're operating from a depleted glass and you're not setting proper boundaries, you will just harness resentment. And therefore you're not going to be the best version of yourself. And therefore you're not actually going to be able to impact and help other people positively because you're going to be operating from a place that's not positive. So boundaries is just to gain your full potential and to be true to yourself, to listen to your gut, and then be able to present your best face to the world, your best energy to help other people and to actually have a good ripple effect that's not betraying yourself, is how I view it.
Oh, and did you suffer with people pleasing? Because I think for me, you know, from the point of, I mean, I didn't look at it as like, ooh, my trauma is influencing how, you know, I let people treat me. But what I found to be very interesting is when I started establishing boundaries, I never saw myself as a people pleaser before that. But when I started establishing boundaries and I started saying no, and I started saying, oh no, I can't do that project right now, or I won't be able to come to your birthday celebration, I can't do this, I found myself actually getting anxiety in the beginning. Because, and then I was like, hey, why are you getting anxiety? You really can't do this project. You neither have the time nor energy to do it. And I was like, wait a minute, where does this stem from? And then I was like, people pleaser, people pleaser, people pleaser. Have you found 100%. That?
Yeah, totally. I think especially it's very easy to understand. It's like, you lose a lot of people that you love. So what are you left with? A big void, right? You're very, very sore and hurting about this void that you now carry. And you go through the world and you encounter people and maybe they're filling that void emotionally. And then you might go, don't leave me, don't leave me, don't leave me, please. You know, it's kind of this subconscious feeling of, I don't want to feel the pain of that void again because you've filled it. And that can translate to friendships, to relationships, to work colleagues. And I think that it takes a lot of effort and energy to realize why you're reacting that particular way and why you are committing to something that is completely disrespecting any of your boundaries. I find whenever I set a boundary for myself and respect it, I actually feel wholesome. Whether the person is there or not, or whatever ripple effect is happening, I feel I was true to myself. And some of that void actually starts to heal and regain strength. So it has the opposite effect than I would have thought, right?
Oh, that's powerful. Because it's exactly what I've been finding with myself. Because I started establishing boundaries with my family unit. And I was like, this is my boundary. And, you know, I had to remove myself, you know, emotionally in every way. And then I started doing it in my job and I started doing it with my friendships, my interpersonal relationships. And even when people would try and date me or whatever, and they behaved in a particular way, ironically in relationships, what I found is, you know, when you're responding to conflict, right, all of us have going to either the one of the three Fs, flight, freeze, or fight? Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Yes. So I found that actually I'm completely the opposite. I shut down. I freeze. Like my emotions freeze. I freeze. Like, and in relationships, I always used to think to myself, why can't I get out what I want to say? You know, like, because genuinely my emotions would completely freeze. And so I'd let people get away with awful behavior. And then when we'd break up, I was so confused, or like if we'd like separate or whatever, I would always be so confused how they had such a great version of our relationship and I had such an awful experience. And I'm like, one of us is living in a crazy reality. And, you know? And then I started to realize, oh, it's because I was a doormat. Like I was literally like, lay me down and walk all over me. That's who I am. And all of a sudden, when I started establishing boundaries, what it started doing was like when people misbehaved, like, you know, this person that I had in my life in December, I actually could say, I was like, no, you are acting like this and I don't appreciate it. And, you know, these are your issues. You need to go deal with that. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I've got a voice.
Yeah. And I mean, there's such power in realizing that other people obviously have issues as well and not wearing them. You know, that's the whole point of not wearing the suit jacket. It's like, I am not putting this on myself because it's not mine. Right. And sometimes it's interesting to look at your back and make sure you're not wearing a closet, you know, of things that does not belong to you. It's nice to have a closet to choose from, but not on your back.
That's so true. But you know what I actually find super interesting? The cognitive dissonance I think we all carry as human beings, right? What I'm trying to do now is I don't want to define myself as any one thing in particular in terms of, I don't want to like put this pressure on myself that I am this morally righteous person. I've never seen myself that way. And you and I have very interesting, you know, thoughts around what is good, what is bad, what is evil, all that stuff. So I've clearly never related to that. But I know for me, I'd identify myself like I'm such a strong woman and I'm this and I'm that. And so I'd have a cognitive dissonance when things that did not align with me, in this case, it was relationships. And in other cases, it was other things. Because I was like, in my career, I'm so strong. I'm so, in my public image, I'm so strong. But when I come into these interpersonal relationships, I don't recognize myself. And it's almost like I'm living two realities. And almost like when I started merging the realities, and I was like, I'm neither strong nor weak. I ebb and I flow and I become whatever the situation demands. Except now, I trust myself more because I'm making decisions that are in attunement with the version I keep becoming. And I think for me, like I see it all the time, actually, you know, with there was a recent scandal about like this social media influencer, Derek Jackson, I believe his name is. He would come online and he would trash me. Trash them like a cheating man is this, and woman, you deserve better, and you know, this is how you should be treating these people. The irony is, he really gained a lot of, you know, traction and notoriety because he was saying what women want to hear, that the perfect men exist. I just never date them. Then the issue came out. He's been cheating for 12 years almost. The man's been cheating while he's been a hypocrite online. And it was just, it's just a, well, also he comes across very narcissistic, but he does not relate to the Derek Jackson, because he speaks about Derek Jackson over there when he's speaking about cheating. But him, he's a great guy. He's teaching you all this wisdom, but Derek Jackson is a cheater, you know? And I just like, I watched this and I thought, holy crap. That is what happens when we take these roles in society, where you become a subconscious role model, not because you stepped onto the perch and you are like, hi, my name is Candace, and I am now a role model of forgiveness. No, people put you there. But if you choose to inhabit those qualities and you don't make yourself human, you start establishing yourself and getting so closely identified with that, right? And I don't know if this has happened to you. I see it with people identify as being a wife, or like being a media personality or whatever it is. And they leave themselves so little room to grow and change. You know, do you find this in your life? Have you seen this happen?
Yeah, well, I think this goes back to the light and shadows kind of analogy, right? Because we are multifaceted people. When you make the statement, I am strong, I would venture to say that you wouldn't know that you're strong had you not been weak at some point. You wouldn't know just how strong you are had you not witnessed something that made you feel the direct opposite, right? And I think that, you know, with this guy that you're talking about, I haven't seen this, but, you know, it brings me back to another Mexican saying, dime de qué presumes y te diré de qué careces, which is, tell me what you're boasting about and I'll tell you what you're lacking. And I think that that often happens through the world, where it's like, sometimes people, we put something forward as a shield, because we don't want to see a truth, right? And it sounds like perhaps, I don't know this person, perhaps that's what he was doing. He did not want to look at what he was doing. Perhaps he felt guilt, perhaps he felt shame, who knows? And so he's putting this persona forward of what should be to not confront the battle at the core, right? And oftentimes I think that that can happen where it's too scary to see something perceived as negative about yourself, which we all have. Like, nobody here is a saint. And you and I have had this conversation about, try to find one absolutely good person with no bad whatsoever. Not Gandhi, not Mother Teresa, not a single president. We cannot find that person. Why? Because we're human. And as humans, we are multifaceted, and we have, you know, just to use the title of that book, but shades of gray, right? We have all the shades of gray. And I think the more we try to ignore it, I mean, it goes back to Jungian psychology, befriending your shadow. We all walk around with a shadow. A lot of us try to not look at it because we're told that it's ugly and we're told that it's bad, right? But once we realize that actually we're composed of both light and darkness, and this thing can be our asset because it'll teach us our flaws. It'll teach us where we can grow. And sometimes it can uphold us to become the best version of ourselves in the opposite direction. But if you don't see it there walking behind you and being a part of you and just ignoring it, I think you're actually lacking something. Oh. So, yeah, that's my opinion.
That is a very powerful opinion. And I wanted to know, like, geez, because you and I can talk for hours, and I don't want this conversation to go on for hours, but what I really want to know is, I mean, you've had so many different experiences of overcoming trauma, and you spoke about, you know, you had this time in your life where you really did freeze in this, you know, you didn't freeze, but you were in this moment that you consider weak, or you were a weaker version of yourself, or just disassociated from yourself, really. How did you, because I mean, I see people living in that disassociated state for a long time. Some people never end up breaking out of it. And I want to know, like, what are the steps that you took to break out of it? And, you know, that some people may be able to apply in their life when they're thinking.
Yeah, I mean, the hardest thing for me with a sexual assault was that I froze. And I have a very strong, direct personality. I've had to defend myself in many circumstances internationally in different countries and different projects and assignments. And it's so hard for me to reconcile that part of myself, that part of myself existed in that moment, because it still to this day frustrates me. I think what had to happen, which is very hard, is kindness towards myself. Because it was realizing that sometimes we do feel out of control and we don't know how we're going to react in any given moment. This was the one place in the world where I knew I was safe. I knew that nothing could go wrong. And even though my gut told me, this is a bit weird, things are turning, I'm not sure about this, my brain went, how dare you think this of someone that is so dear to you, of someone that's like an older brother? How dare you? And I did not listen to my gut. I put my mind, my reason first. This cannot be happening, right? And so I froze. And I think it was many years of therapy and understanding that this was a natural response, because before I used to think it was only flight or fight, but there was no freeze. And I had to actually go to understand that it is possible to freeze, because it happened to me and it happens to many people. And I think it's just the ability to face it. The hardest part is facing something that you don't want to see about yourself. I didn't want to see that had happened to me. I didn't want to see that I had that moment that I did perceive as weakness, and now I just perceive as a psychological response. And it was just playing with that, going to therapy for it, expressing myself artistically through it. For me, it was art. It was speaking to other survivors, using my skill set to put my story out and other people's stories out, and understanding that I wasn't alone. That was huge for me. It was building community and understanding that this happens to so many people. And we all carry this guilt and shame and tragedy around for such a long time. And it's a conscious choice not to wear it. And sometimes, even now, 10 years later, I can still find myself wearing it, for instances, or I might have a trigger moment and I go, oh my God, that's why it's the spiral of containment, because sometimes you think you're like at the top and then you're at square one for a moment and then you come back up, right? But it's about not being too harsh on yourself and realizing that you have the capacity to choose where you're going to stand, and never denying that capacity. And by that, I also mean you can choose to feel like crap for a while, because that in itself can be healing, but just don't stay there too long.
Ooh, I love it. And what is some of the worst that, like, what's one of the worst pieces of advice you received while you were healing? Because I know I receive some really bad advice sometimes when it comes to like healing. And I'm just like, that is a terrible piece of advice. You know, it's well-meaning, it's well-intentioned, but usually it actually is the worst thing to do.
Yeah, for me, it was don't tell anyone. And the worst part is that came from many women in my family who only disclosed that they'd been sexually assaulted as well, sometimes by people within my own family, and had remained silent for decades. And it actually caused a bit of a dissonance between us, because I did not want to. The more people said, don't say anything, the more they put fuel in the fire. Because I realized how systemic the problem was, not just in my family, but globally, and how necessary it was to start talking about it, because otherwise we're never going to break it. And I think a lot of the times, you know, if we make a mistake or if something happens to us that's, you know, taboo, a lot of the times people will say, just don't say anything, just move on, just don't. And it might be, you know, well-intentioned. Some people said that it was going to come back to bite me, that it was going to be something that was going to hinder me by speaking out about it. But had I kept this as quiet, I don't think I would have been able to heal it. It would have been like an express pot, and who knows what direction it would have burst, you know? Yeah, so that was the worst one for me.
And a quality of yours that you believe like pushed you through it, because I know for me when I first shared my story of forgiveness and it became like a media just whirlwind, I started getting a lot of threats. Like I started, people were just like, I had a lot of supporters, don't get me wrong, and they were amazing and far outweighed the hate and the like, those kind of threats. But I remember there was a point where my family said to me, like, maybe you should just stop talking about it. And I remember saying to them, you know what, if it's my time to go, because I stood in my truth and I stood with conviction, then it's just my time to go. I'm not going to be shut down because people don't like what I have to say. It's my truth. I'm not forcing you to adopt it as yours, right? And so for me, what I realized in that moment is I'm an incredibly stubborn and conviction-driven person. If I believe in something, I am all in it. Like I cannot be shaken. I cannot be moved. Like it is just impossible. And I find the same quality in you in many ways. But I want to know the quality in yourself that you find has gotten you to this point where something that for a lot of people, they would have been afraid to embody, you've embodied with such grace.
Well, I don't know how graceful it might have been, but I suppose the one word that comes to mind is just resilience. And I think resilience was simply something that I witnessed. It's going back to experience. If you live in a country where you see life and death happen often, where you see extreme poverty and extreme wealth, where you see people lose their money overnight, where you witness violence, where you witness extreme levels of fear, where you see crimes happen in front of you sometimes, it's like, but you wake up in the morning and people carry on, you know? I remember one time my mom driving in the car and a very well-dressed man came up to the window to ask for directions. So she put it down and she was wearing a little chain. My mom was quite religious, so she wore a Jesus chain. And this guy just ripped it off of her. It actually left, it was a very, very thick chain and it left, you know, a bit of blood on her neck and this kind of stuff. And I was very, very shocked. And what did we do? We carried on. You know, we had a moment of, okay, that was freaky. Now we're going to carry on going to do the groceries we need to do or whatever it is you need to do. And you just realize you carry on. You do need to take a pause to decompress, but you witness people carry on and you know that you can carry on with the small things and the big things. Because the alternative is to pack up your bags, cocoon, become a hermit and just wait for death. And if that's your choice, you're entitled to your choice. But that is what you're doing. You are not allowing yourself to live your life. And, you know, we do have to go out there with a raincoat and with an umbrella and sometimes with a shield. But we got to go out there. We got to go out there. Otherwise, we just don't get the rewards of facing things. So I think resilience is definitely something that can be learned and practiced and is definitely what got me through.
Oh, that was so powerful. And that is so true. And I think I realized that even like, you know, personally, where it is, you know, you just keep it moving. Like, I think for me, it has been that too, right? Like, yes, sometimes it does serve to your detriment. But I think in so many ways in life, all of us have got to keep it moving. And as you said, the alternative is literally to just curl up in a ball and die and wait for death to come. Or like, you know, you're like, because there is no alternative, right? There's no alternative to life because life is going to happen to us all, every single person. And it's just understanding that life is going to happen. There's going to be good days and bad days. And when the bad days come, I need to face them and move through them because I know on the other side, the good days will be there, right? And coming back very quickly to your career, I mean, you've had such an illustrious career and just you're continuing to just grow and grow and grow and become better and better and better. But what is one career highlight that you have that you are just so proud of?
Well, I mean, since we've made this episode about, you know, sexual violence at a core and trauma, I would say that being able to harness my skill set, my cinematography, my visual, my filmmaking skill sets to listen and empathize with other survivors and tell their story in a multimedia kind of way and make this book and now have this exhibition as something that's able to travel. I think that for me is definitely a height moment of my career because I realized that my skill sets can be used for good and that it can be used to help other people, but also to heal and move collectively towards healing and not stand for things that are detrimental to humanity moving forward. So that I think would be my moment.
Amazing. Oh, this has been incredible. And the last question I will ask you is if you had a time machine and you could go back in time, give your 18-year-old self any advice, what would you say?
Ooh, my 18-year-old self, wow. I think I would have said, trust your gut.
Ooh.
Always, always trust your gut because it knows. And who knows? Who knows what would have happened?
Oh, that got me. That got me. That's a great one. And I think in any situation, career, love, friendship, life, I think your gut, there is a very distinct feeling that your gut gives you that nothing else does. Nothing. So that's a beautiful piece of advice. Oh, my friend, it is an honor to know you. I love you. And thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Oh, it's completely mutual. Thank you for having me.
Ooh, man, this interview was slightly different, as I'm sure you could tell, because Elissa and I always err into the side of our friendship where we start having a conversation and it stops being an interview. I hope you guys loved it as much as I enjoyed speaking to her. Let me know what stood out for you. One of the things that really caught me was when she said, always trust your gut. How often do we not trust ourselves, not trust our gut? But I really hope this episode was as informative and helpful to you as it always is to me speaking to her. I love you guys, and I'll see you next week.